Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Pledge Music, Song Royalties and Woodstock. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
It feels like a very long time since we've done this.
What, recorded a standard proper edition of Setlist?
Is it that long?
The music business podcast from CMU. We're on a very tight deadline with this edition as well.
But we really need to sort this out. How
how long is it? Yeah, it's a good use of our time. We're on such a tight deadline this week. I had to down my soup in one go before coming into studio.
That's how you have it anyway.
I am now very hot as a result.
Good. Well, it's lucky it's not boiling in here then.
Well, it's a good job also it's not TV. Remember that time I did that thing on Turkish telly? You know? I was kind of sweating all over the place because it was a really hot day.
Yes, listeners interested can go and find the episode of this podcast where I embedded that in the show notes.
So if this was on camera...
I might embed it in this week's as well, because that was funny.
If this was on camera, it would be quite similar. But fortunately, hopefully, providing I don't sweat so much that it drips onto the electrics and it all blows up, you won't know.
It will be a dramatic conclusion to the series.
That having downed... Are you assuming I would die as a result of that explosion? Is that why the series is ending?
Yeah.
You think the conclusion of the story would be a soup-slash-sweat-based electronic explosion? Mm. Would that be a satisfactory conclusion?
I think it would be what the listeners would want.
Of the Setlist narrative. We're back!
Yes!
And we're talking about the big developments in this business of music from the last 7 days.
Yes, a week when, well, actually not a week when, the Great Escape happened. That was what I was trying to segue into.
And, but that wasn't last week.
No, I know. That's why I faltered and stumbled over it.
Let's
just talk about The Great Escape is what I'm basically saying. What happened? I didn't go.
Recorded. Is it any good? Well, it was a lot better this year. And I don't know whether that's a coincidence that it was the year that you didn't come and things went.
I basically wasn't there last year.
And when I say it was a lot better, what I mean by that is, obviously, our conferences are always brilliant. I mean, everyone knows that. There's no secret about that. But behind the scenes this year, things were much smoother with your absence. None of the last-minute panics behind the scenes.
I'm not sure any of that's ever been my fault.
Also, brand new conference venue this year, which was brilliant. Joy's Wind, Waterfront, everything in one place, including all three of the CMU conferences. We're going to talk more about one of those in a bit. So rather than talking about the panels and the conferences, I will just say we had our Elevate program, which was our new professional development program. Supported by Arts Council England, we had a delegation of 30 super delegates, I was calling them.
Oh, right.
Actually, sometimes I was calling them elevators. So they were 30 early career music business professionals, some working in the live space, some for labels, some were managers, some worked in music education, and they all had a curated, enhanced, subsidised experience, which allowed them to get much, much more out of the Great Escape experience, to meet more people, to learn more stuff. And also to network with each other. And then basically I did a debrief with them each day, finding out what their favourite bits of the conference have been, what they learned, etc., etc. And it's always really interesting to meet people who are at that stage in their career. So they've been doing it for a few years. They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
But to get a totally different perspective. And one really interesting bit of feedback that came through is obviously at conferences in recent years, there's been a lot of talk around mental health.
There has.
In the music industry, which we've also...
Not least at our own conferences.
A few years ago now, yes, we did a whole half day, didn't we, looking at mental health in the music industry for both artists and those people working in the business a few years ago now. And since then, it's been happening at lots of conferences. And that topic came up during one of the debriefs. And several people in the room were saying the fact people are having a much more frank conversation about mental health in music, whether that's from an artist perspective or behind the scenes perspective, was really good. Everyone welcomed that. Although then some people did sort of say that some of it does feel a bit token gesture.
Yeah.
And that maybe the way the industry is responding to this new conversation around mental health is doing little initiatives like, well, we'll do yoga on a Tuesday morning.
Yeah.
Or here's something that will help you relax one weekend.
Yeah.
But actually, there are some fundamental flaws with the way the business is structured.
Yes.
Which are exacerbating these problems, and that maybe music companies, big and small, have done a lot less to deal with that than they have with some of these other initiatives. Which isn't to say that those other initiatives aren't worthwhile, but not in isolation.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting. It is a few years now since we put the spotlight on mental health in the core programme of The Great Escape. Some of our partners have kept that conversation going elsewhere at the event, but we haven't put it in the core programme. And I said to those people, we need to have a conversation at some point because that's really interesting. And I'd love to carry on that conversation and then see if we could have some different discussions or presentations, at a, whether it's the Great Escape or another event, that could actually look at how we could move things forward in a much more dramatic way. So look at that. I went to the Great Escape to do a lot of talking about education and streaming and royalties and marketing. But I learned some stuff too, mainly from the 30 Elevate delegates this year. So that almost was the highlight for me, I think. Out of a few days that had a lot of highlights, not least the launch of the MMF Song Royalties Guide, more on which in a bit.
Yep.
And of course, I got to interview Chili Gonzalez.
Yes, and you didn't cry.
And I didn't cry. It was brilliant. And well, next year's the 15th anniversary of The Great Escape, 10th year of CMU presenting content there. And I'm going to have to do something special to match interviewing Chili Gonzalez on stage. So that was The Great Escape. If you came, thank you for coming. We had a great time. But that's not what we're here.
I didn't.
We didn't come.
Exactly. My highlight was staying at home.
Not that.
Very relaxing not going. I really recommend it.
Ignore Andy Malt. Everything he says is nonsense.
I was unable to go.
You were deeply disappointed.
I was devastated that I was unable to go.
That you were unable to go. This is not what we're here to talk about this week, except it is, because we're coming onto the Song Royalties Guide in a bit. But we've got other things to talk about as well.
Yeah, we're not here to talk about that at all. I don't know why you went on about it for so long.
Except we are a bit, but we're not.
Okay, well, we are going to talk about this week Woodstock 50's rapid descent into becoming 2019's Fyre Festival, and as you say, the MMF's new Song Royalties Guide. Not sure you did say that, but you alluded to it. But first, Pledge Music has announced that it's going into administration after it failed to agree a deal to sell itself to a new owner. This could ultimately mean that the company shuts down entirely and looks likely to mean that artists who have raised money via the platform in recent months will never, ever see that cash.
Yes, so this is an unfortunate conclusion, seemingly, to a long-running story, which we haven't actually talked about on Setlist,
I think at any point it's been a possible topic. It's been likely too much in development. We were always waiting for answers to whatever development just happened.
And then weeks when we had the answers, I probably buggered off somewhere and we didn't do
a proper
edition of the podcast. But we have been reporting on it in the CMU Daily throughout. So Pledge Music, of course, is a direct-to-fan platform. It's a fan-funding crowdsourcing platform. It's a pre-order platform. It's all of those things.
Yes.
In the early days, it was
actually interestingly talk about it as a crowdfunding platform now, which there was a point where I got told off for calling it crowdfunding platform. No, it's a pre-order platform. Actually, I think that was when crowdfunding had a bit of a bad rep because lots of crowdfunding platforms had gone out of business.
Yeah, which it might be about to happen again.
So maybe it's going to be a pre-order platform again.
Certainly when Pledge launched, it was positioned very much as a fan funding platform. Fan funding had been a big thing for a number of years. There had been an assortment of similar sites, but different, that had launched in kind of the mid-2000s. So we had things like Bandstocks, Slice the Pie,
Celeband,
and other sites with equally terrible names, which were crowdsourcing sites, but with a music focus.
Mm.
And then Pledge came along, and Pledge was different to those previous sites.
Yes.
In that, what those previous sites did was they encouraged people to put money into an artist project on the promise that as an investor, you would share in future royalties created by whatever was being created.
Yeah.
You wouldn't actually have a share in any of the copyrights. Those would remain with the artists. But future income would be shared out between all of the people who put money in, which is a true crowdfunding investment type system.
Yeah.
Pledge came along and said, well, we're going to take elements of that, but we're going to do it differently. We're not going to offer fans a cut of future revenue because A, their cut of future revenue is probably 0.00001 pence.
Yeah.
Plus, actually, fans don't want a cut of future revenue. They're not putting money into these projects because they're kind of investing like you might invest in some sort of tech startup. They're putting money in because they like the artist. They want to see the artist do something great. They want some music, some events, some experiences on the back of it. So the idea was, rather than actually having people investing in the project, have people pledge to spend some money up front so the artist can then do the project and then give something cool in return depending how much they pledge.
Yes, and it was different because it had been set up by an artist, Benji Rogers, who kind of, I remember meeting him after he first set it up and him saying, I was looking for something that worked for me the way I wanted to work as an artist, and there just wasn't anything.
Yes.
And so I decided to set that thing up for myself.
Yeah, even though in the years prior to us having that meeting with Benji, all these fan funding platforms had launched, it was interesting that he said he'd looked at all of them. He liked the idea of fan funding, but none of them did it in a way that he felt, well, certainly he wanted, and the artists he was talking to wanted, hence Pledge Music. But I suppose because Pledge Music was different in that you weren't actually investing in a true sense, you were pledging, hence the name.
Well, it's basic level, and this is why they called it a pre-order platform. It was basically you said, I will give you £10 now to buy the CD of the album that you have not made yet.
And I suppose, crucially, that meant that it was part fan funding, part pre-order. So once fan funding fell out of fashion, they were able to say, oh, well, we're a pre-order platform. And you're right, over their history, at one point they were saying, we're a fan funding platform. And then at another point, they were like, oh, no, we're a pre-order platform. And then it got to the point where they said, oh, we offer two services.
Yes.
We have a fan funding service and a pre-order service. They were, in essence, they were the same thing. It was just different ways of communicating what you were doing. Obviously, there are other crowdsourcing platforms that work in a similar way. The most obvious is probably Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And Kickstarter has a music strand. So that there is a strand on Kickstarter where artists can go and raise money. But I think a couple of differences between Pledge and Kickstarter, the biggest being that Pledge was specifically set up for music, hence Pledge Music.
Yes.
And so therefore was much more skewed towards the way a musician, an artist in the music space might go about raising money, talking to their fans, etc. Also, as the business grew, the company was a little bit more hands-on in supporting the artists who were using it. It wasn't just a case of we've got a website.
Yeah.
Sign up. It was a case of, okay, let us explain how you use this website. And I remember at one event, because we have Pledge, various people, Benji, but other people in the team as well, talking at various events over the years. And I remember one person who didn't quite get it saying, how can you help me raise money? How can you help me reach people who would raise money? Now, actually, in the end, Pledge did have a bit of a community of people who were looking for artists to support if they were doing interesting, quirky projects. But the person on the panel was very upfront and said, well, we're not going to find you people to invest. You have to have a fan base to start with.
Yeah.
And these are some ways you might go about building a fan base. But if you've got 1,000 fans who are excited about what you're doing, and you think half of them will put a bit of money in, and maybe 50 of them might put quite a bit of money in, then there's probably a basic pledge campaign that we could do.
Yeah.
But don't just sign up to our website thinking you're going to suddenly find 1,000 people who all want to give you £100. That's not how it works. So they were much more upfront about how you could run a campaign on there. But as I say, they were good at educating people and then helping them work out what products they might offer, how they might go about filling that, etc. So they were more hands-on, I guess, is my point. And they
would
take a slightly bigger cut than Kickstarter in return for that. But it was a great platform and doesn't work for everybody. But for some artists, it really worked.
Yes.
And obviously, as various people have pointed out, since Pledge has been through all these problems in the last year or so, there are lots of ways you can take pre-order. Any direct-to-consumer store, Music Glue, or any of those which are not specifically aimed at music, like Shopify or Sells, these will all allow you to take a pre-order. So you can do pre-orders on pretty much any selling platform. You could do it on your own website with a PayPal link. So anyone could do a pre-order, but I suppose what Pledge provided was a platform, a plan, an infrastructure around which you could set that campaign up, take the money. And then the comms was a really important part of a successful Pledge campaign because it was about making the fans who had pledged feel that they were now part of like a special super club.
Yeah.
And you gave them lots of other information and bits of content. So they really enjoyed the experience. So they were more likely to pledge next time. So for some artists and some managers, Pledge had become a really important part of their businesses. And you had brand new artists doing it. You had big name artists doing it. You had a lot of heritage acts. So artists who'd done the major label thing back in the day, had a decently sized fan base remaining who they could tour once a year, and then they would use Pledge to generate income to fund an album or whatever. So there were lots of good things about Pledge, but over a year ago now, we started to hear there were some issues with artists getting the money they were due from their Pledge campaigns. Once they'd completed the campaign, they'd got enough money pledged, they were starting to do whatever it was they were said they were going to do, record an album, create some merch, but the money was starting to come through slower than people would like.
Yeah, and then in October last year, Pledge admitted that it was having some financial issues, but it said it had made various internal changes, including putting in a new executive team, that would overcome those issues. The money would all start flowing again. Everything was fine now. Except everything wasn't fine now, And in January, after artists continued to complain that they weren't getting their money, obviously it's money they've raised, it's money that's due to them, Pledge admitted again that it was continuing to have problems making those payments. In February, then Benji Rogers returned to the company, having actually left as its CEO back in 2017, came back on a voluntary basis to try to sort things out at the company that he'd started. And initially, there was quite a lot of positivity around that because Benji, he's quite an inspiring character. And going back to that first meeting again, I mean, we were very down on these crowdfunding platforms, a lot of which had started to go out of business. And then we met him and he was just like, this is how I'm doing it. It's going to be great. And we're like, oh, yeah, he seems all right.
Yeah.
Seems to know what he's talking about.
And although...
And so, lots of people, him coming back filled a lot of people with quite a lot of optimism at that point.
And although Benji, as you say, had left Pledge, he was no longer working for the business. And obviously he had another startup, which he'd been talking about a lot at conferences, which was the Dot Blockchain startup. He was still very much associated with the business and clearly desperately wanted that business to survive and to work. And also, the other thing that had happened in the latter half of last year, as the late payments started to build and as more and more artists started to talk about this on the social networks and etc., I think the comms had started to slow down at Pledge.
Yeah.
They weren't communicating to the artists. And of course, obviously, when you've got a business going through some tricky times, it's understandable why you don't want to say too much. And sometimes you'll have lawyers in the building, accountants in the building. I've no idea whether this was the case, but often they will have people in the building saying, we shouldn't say anything.
Yeah.
But when you've got people desperately wanting some cash because they've got 1,000 fans who they've promised they're going to send a box set to suddenly not have your emails being returned is not a good thing.
Yeah.
And I think the hope was when Benji came back on board, albeit, as you say, as a voluntary advisor, he was being a bit more communicative.
Yes.
I'm not sure that's a word.
No.
He was communicating
more. Not
with
that many syllables.
He was updating people mainly through his Medium blog as to what was happening as he saw it.
Yes.
And then on the grapevine, we heard that he had told, I think it was that he had told the founder of one of the other companies that Pledge had acquired along the way, which actually a few weeks before the administration was confirmed, they then sold off. It was a platform where you could exchange an email address for a download. And so the rumor on the grapevine was that there was definitely a company interested in acquiring Pledge. So the idea that maybe we could have a happy outcome of this, that was definitely still in progress. There was a potential buyer, but the potential buyer was sounding out managers and labels and artists to see just how much reputation damage had been done for all these problems last year. And whether or not that would stop people working with Pledge in the future and therefore make it a much more riskier investment was what we were hearing, although that never actually came from an official source.
Yes, although, I mean, in the interim, I mean, I said there was a positivity when Benji came back, although I think that disappeared entirely shortly after he returned when they suspended artist payments completely. They stopped taking new campaigns. They advised people to just end campaigns that they'd started. Clearly, that wasn't looking good. They were saying, like, it's just been suspended while we sort out a buyer and then we'll start up again, we'll sort it all out. But that went on and on for a number of months. The communication started slowing down again. Then last month, it was kind of, I mean, they said sources. I'm assuming there was a sources from Pledge itself saying, oh, no, this deal's going to be done. They're just, as you said, doing that due diligence, going out to see if those bigger labels and artists and management companies are going to come back to Pledge once the deal is done. But that was sort of a little glimmer of like, oh, maybe this is going to turn out all right. But then, unfortunately, at the end of that due diligence, it did not turn out all right because that deal fell through, that buyer pulled out, and then Benji Rogers came out with a statement saying that, unfortunately, as a result of this, the company is going to go into administration.
And of course, the big question, as you said at the outset, is will those artists who were owed their money see any of it? Because if the company goes into administration, they just become creditors along with any other people who are owed money by the business. And then the administrator will come in, he'll sell off any assets that they have, and then share that money out between the creditors. And it would not surprise me if the result of that is that a lot of these artists see little, if any, of the money that they are owed.
Yes. Well, it's estimated that the outstanding money owed is somewhere between $1 and $3 million. And whether or not Pledge Music has assets of that value and enough to pay, presumably there are other creditors as well, aside from the artist.
And generally speaking, in these scenarios, the banks and the taxman get their money first.
And the administrator.
And the administrator gets it first. And of course, there are employees who will also be caught up in all of this. And that's a real shame too. So I think questions will be asked, will anybody get paid? If they don't, or if people only see a fraction of what they are paid, Other questions will then immediately follow. UK Music here in the UK have already said that maybe the Competition and Markets Authority should investigate the UK side of the business. Pledge had both UK division and US division, and indeed operated in other countries as well. I suspect we'll get lots of people who were there in the last few months of Pledge coming out with various versions of events. I know that because actually Digital Music News website in the US ran various revelations from supposedly a recent Pledge employee, which was confirming quite a bit of what I'd heard. I mean, this is all gossip, but that most of the problems began in the US side of the business and that the UK side of the business was doing fine. And then because of arguably, allegedly possible overexpenditure by the management who kind of came in at Pledge 2 or 3 years ago, I think. So very much not the original management. Management, yeah, who were brought in after they'd had a cash injection from new investors. Maybe some bad decisions were made. Costs were run up, which shouldn't have been run up on the American side of the business. But I think the biggest question that's going to be asked throughout this, and let's hope that this doesn't mean that artists and, I suppose, crucially, fans are put off the idea of pre-order campaigns, fan-funding campaigns, whatever we're calling them, because I think the concept is brilliant.
Yeah.
But the big, big, big question that will definitely be asked is, why wasn't the artist's money put into a separate account, what we'd often refer to as an escrow account, so that the artist's money is not part of the business? So whenever money comes in through the platform, it goes into an escrow account, which is the artist's account, it's their money, and all Pledge does is takes its commission out of that so that that cash can't be used as running costs for the business if the business is going through a tricky period and is protected if the company goes down. And actually, those sites we talked about earlier, the Celebans, etc., that was a conversation at the time about, well, where is the money sitting? Are we going to have a separate account which is not in the control of the business itself so that money is protected if something bad happens? So that was part of the conversation around fan funding and crowdsourcing in the early days. And so I think, as I say, the big, 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 big question, I've said too many big questions now, will be, well, why was it not set up like that? Why wasn't that money protected? Anybody who wants to take the place of Pledge, I think there is a huge opportunity now to be that platform.
Yeah.
Maybe some of the other direct-to-fan stores will ramp up their pre-order services to fill that gap. But similar questions will probably be asked of those platforms. What are you doing to protect the money? And also, I think it's worth having a conversation from an artist's perspective of all of those different companies and platforms, whether it's direct to fan, whether it's streaming, whether it's ticketing, who are holding money on behalf of artists, particularly where the fan feels like they've given the money directly to the artist,
yes,
and not to some sort of retailer in the middle. How is that money being managed? Is it being protected? And I think that's possibly a wider conversation that should be had, although none of that helps the artists and the fans, and indeed the employees at Pledge who have been caught up this mess.
Yeah, and they, I mean, the extent to which those artists have lost out to differing levels, that is the big scandal of this, because like we say, you're handing over your money to buy a CD, say, but really that money is there to cover different bits of the project, but you might be raising that money so that you can hire the studio to record that album. So if you don't get that money, then the entire project is lost. And Pledge was always big on saying, we won't let you use this platform unless you have a proper plan. You can't just say, oh, I want some money. You need to have a plan for what you're going to do with it. And so you factor in marketing costs and production costs. And obviously, I mean, you've got to have the production costs for the CDs and vinyl, whatever that people have bought. I mean, I know an artist who had done a Pledge campaign and largely the money was for vinyl pressing. And he has actually managed to record the album and press CDs. So actually he's managed to get his album out. But a lot of the people buying it were pledging for vinyl. And having not received that money, there is no vinyl, can't afford to manufacture it.
And indeed, some artists, once the delay started occurring, were covering some of those costs and putting them on credit cards and will now have to take a hit. So yes, it will be either fans being disappointed or artists having to incur extra costs or a combination of the two.
Yeah, so a real shame to lose a platform like Pledge that I do actually think was really good, but much worse for the many, many artists who have, by no fault of their own, ended up caught up in this. Still to come on this week's set list, the saga of Woodstock's 50th anniversary celebrations. But now, while we were away, the Music Managers Forum published the latest in its series of Dissecting the Digital Dollar reports, this time looking at publishing royalties. To put together this report, they got some guy called Chris Cook to do it, with whom I have managed to secure an exclusive interview. Chris Cook, hello.
Hello.
Tell me about this report you've written. Sounds great.
Okay, this is the latest in the Dissecting Digital Dollar reports that MMF have published and that we here at CME Insights have helped to produce. This one is the Song Royalties Guide. So it's a guide to song royalties.
Yes.
That's nice and easy, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's the only simple thing about this piece.
It really is.
Of digital dollar work.
We're going to run through this very quickly, but it's complicated, isn't it?
To give some background, you know all this, unless this is the first edition of Setlist you've ever listened to. But everybody else knows that...
If it is, please do subscribe on your podcast platform of choice.
We have no time for plugging subscriptions at the moment. So, you all know that MMF launched the Dissecting Digital Dollar Project a few years ago now, basically to try and demystify the streaming business, which is complicated, and so that managers and the artists and songwriters they work with and other people in each artist team could better understand how Spotify and services like Spotify work from a rights and royalties perspective.
Yeah.
So the deals that have been done between the music industry and the streaming services, what do those deals look like? And then crucially, what happens to the money as it flows through the system each month? And this latest phase of Digital Dollar specifically put the spotlight on song royalties. Now, the original report and the book we subsequently published did explain how a Spotify-type service was licensing the song rights and was doing deals with both collecting societies and music publishers in order to secure the right to stream songs as well as recordings. So we covered all that in the original report and in the book, but MMF decided to specifically put the spotlight on this and to go into this in a lot more detail. Because what we've noticed in recent years is within the music community, the people who remain most critical about streaming and the streaming business and the streaming services are the songwriters.
Yeah.
And by that, I really mean those people who predominantly write. They're not artists who also write. They mainly write and produce music for other people. And so therefore, their copyrights are their primary revenue stream. It isn't that they're making money from their song rights as well as getting money from recordings and touring and director van and all of that. The song is their revenue stream. And a lot of those songwriters and their managers remain critical about streaming. And that's interesting because if you actually look at how the streaming business works, as defined in the original Dissecting Digital Dollar report, ultimately streaming is a revenue share game. The streaming services like Spotify get a load of money by selling subscriptions and advertising, and at the end of every month, they share that money out with the music industry on a revenue share basis. And with the most recent deals, what we're starting to see is, of all the money, the record industry, so the labels and the artists, are getting probably somewhere around 55% of the money, maybe slightly less than that now. The services are aiming to keep about 30% of the money. I mean, the advances they pay, the guarantees they make, often mean they don't get to keep 30%. But
yeah,
if you just look at the revenue share arrangement, they're keeping about 30%, which leaves probably somewhere between 10 and 15% going to the song. And increasingly, we're at the upper end of that bracket, getting closer to 15% of revenue going to the songwriters. Now, immediately you will notice a lot more is going to the recording and the
yes,
labels and the artists than is going to the writers and the publishers. And that's a debate that we've had a lot. Although there has been a slight repositioning, a slight reslicing of the thing we call the digital pie, so that songwriters and publishers are getting slightly more now than they were in the early days of streaming. So possibly the very first deals, they were nearer the 10% point and now they're nearer the 15% point. But here's the crucial thing. Actually, the publishers and writers have always been on a rev share with the record industry. So that when the record industry makes money, traditionally through selling CDs, a portion of the money generated by the selling of discs was passed over to writers and publishers.
Yeah.
And those royalties were usually referred to as the mechanical royalties. They were usually paid in through the collective licensing system. And usually they were industry standard rates. And those varied from country to country. But for example, here in the UK, the classic MCPS license, so the license a label got when it released a CD, meant that the label had to hand over 8% of the money to the publishers who would then share it with the writers. Except that was 8% of wholesale, not retail.
Yeah.
And if you look at what they were paying on retail, MCPS do actually have a 6% license. So it's 6% of retail. I mean, it very rarely used because generally the mechanical royalty on a CD was done on the wholesale price. But crucially, 8% of wholesale, 6% of retail. This 12 to 15% that the song is getting from streaming is of the retail price. It's of the total sum of money coming in.
Yeah.
So that means when the money comes in for streaming and is shared out between recordings and songs, okay, the recording still gets a lot more than the song, but the song share is probably double, possibly more than double, what it was on a CD.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we know, because we've talked about it endlessly on Setlist, the streaming market is booming, the record industry is back in growth. Every month, more and more money is coming in through the streaming services. So, at the very least, songwriters should be starting to see some kind of benefit from the fact that they get a bigger cut on streaming than they do on CD.
Yeah.
And all the managers of the songwriters speak to say, we're just not seeing that benefit. And that raises a question, well, why? And there are various explanations. So, for example, it takes longer for the money to drip in from streaming than selling a CD on day one. So there's that element to it. There is the issue that in the streaming space, to use old term jargon about albums, the killer tracks are no longer subsidized the filler tracks.
Yeah.
Because it used to be on a 10-track album, but the mechanical royalty money equally got split between the writers of the 10 songs, even if you wrote track 7, which no one ever listened to.
Yeah.
Whereas in the streaming age, if no one listens to track 7, then you don't get any money and the people who wrote the hits get more. There's also the issue, of course, that on newer works, particularly pop songs, there's ever-increasing numbers of writers co-writing.
Yeah.
And the money has to be split between them all. But there is another significant issue, which is what this Song Royalties Guide goes into. So, with the streaming space, in most cases, between the artist and the service, there will be one or more intermediaries. The labels, the distributors, the publishers, the collecting societies, who are actually doing the deal with the streaming service. So the streaming services aren't paying the artist directly. They're paying a label or distributor or collecting society or publisher who then pays the artist or the songwriter. Although that initial entity who does the deal may not have a direct relationship with the artist. It might go from one entity to another entity to another entity to the songwriter. And so this creates what we're calling royalty chains. Between the service and the artist or the songwriter, there will be one, two, three entities down through which the money flows.
Mm.
So the money is flowing down these royalty chains. Now, the crucial point is that the royalty chains on the song side of the business are much more complicated than on the recording side of the business for various reasons, which the guide goes into.
Yes.
I'm not going to explain now because I don't have time. But there are various reasons why the royalty chains on the song side are more complicated. In two ways. First of all, there are often more links in the chain on the song side than on the recording side. Not always, but sometimes. But perhaps more importantly than that, is that a songwriter's money will be flowing down a multitude of chains. So it's not that there is Spotify writer and then there's one royalty chain with two or three links in the chain. Instead, there will be an assortment of royalty chains. And the money will be flowing down lots of royalty chains. So Spotify has some money, and then there's a writer sitting over here. And then there could be 40 different royalty chains down which the money flows. And which royalty chain is being used at any one time will depend on the country. It will depend on the song, it will depend on who publishes the song, it will depend on which collecting society the writer is a member of, it will depend on deals that have been done between different collecting societies, it will depend on how many sub-publishers are involved in the mix. And if you think that sounds complicated already, get this. Multiple chains not only apply to one songwriter, they can apply to single streams of single songs. So you might have a track streaming, song contained within that track, songwriter needs to be paid. Very, very, very approximately in the UK, premium stream, probably about 0.1 of a penny is going through the system. That 0.1 of the penny will be split into three. And half of that money will flow down one side, which would be the mechanical royalty. And then the other half will be split into two again. That's the performing right royalty. And the publisher's share of that will go down one chain and the writer's share will go down another chain for a single stream of a single track. Plus, if it's a co-write and you've got two writers, on that single stream, the money will get split into two, and then each half of that 0.1 of a penny will go down a different set of chains depending on who publishes those writers and what collecting societies they're in.
I mean, if you're looking at a big pop song, you're probably talking more like split into seven.
So it's incredibly complicated. And the reason why this matters to every songwriter who you know is that at every link on the chain, money can be deducted and money can sit in somebody else's bank account. Plus, we have issues that the first link in the chain is responsible for getting the money from the streaming service to start with. They might screw that up, and it might be that no money is flowing down the chains at all. And so what MMF is saying, and there are various recommendations in the guide, so we'll link to it from the notes and you should download it, but one of the key things is saying to all songwriters and the managers and accountants and lawyers who work with those songwriters is, we need more transparency on what chains are being employed. If you're a writer, you're published by this publisher, you're in this society, how is the money flowing as it goes from Spotify to you? What do those chains look like? How many of them are there? And then what is happening at each link in the chain? What money is being deducted? What money is getting delayed? And it could be that a significant portion of the money you are due is getting lost in the system or going to the wrong places. And so that's what Song Royalties Guide is all about. You can download it for free off the MRF website and off the CMU Insights website. And there are a bunch of recommendations in there, some of which are for individual writers and the managers and lawyers and accountants of those writers of what they could be doing now to reduce the impact of all of these complexities. Plus, there are some bigger picture issues that MMF is planning to campaign on to encourage the songwriter community, to encourage the publishers and collecting societies they work with to be much more transparent about the chains they're employing and to ensure that significant sums of money are not getting lost to the system so that writers are getting every single digital dollar they are due. So that is what the Song Royalties Guide is all about. We launched it at The Great Escape. We had various panels and discussions around it. And you can download the guide off the MMF and CMU website. And hopefully we will see the conversation around this continue in the coming months and years. And there are some innovators, both publishers and societies, who are trying to address some of the issues. So hopefully writers can get behind the innovator publishers, the innovator societies, and start to address these issues and make sure that songwriters get bloody well paid when their music gets streamed.
So you can download the Song Royalties Guide at cmuinsights.com/digitaldollar. You'll find various other guides there. You can buy the book, which explains in detail how the streaming services work and how royalties flow out of them, down them, into the music industry at Amazon. I'll put all the links you need in the show notes for this episode, which you'll find at setlistpodcast.com, where you'll also find links for everything we've discussed in this episode. And finally this week, Woodstock, the festival that is happening. Or not happening. Who knows? I don't think anyone knows, but some people are very certain about what they know. This is all very confusing, isn't it? I've started it very confusingly. That's because it's quite confusing. I did refer to it earlier in the show as this year's Fire Festival, which I'd seen various people calling it, and I thought was a bit unfair. We can't just start calling every slightly chaotic festival this year's Fire Festival. But then, thanks to a court ruling this week, we know a bit more about what's been going on at Woodstock. And I really think that it is this year's Fire Festival.
Yeah, so it's 50 years since the original Woodstock Festival took place, hence why they're hoping to stage Woodstock 50 this August.
Yes.
To celebrate that five-decade anniversary. They announced at the start of the year that this was going to happen, and various bold claims were made about how this was going to be a fantastic celebration of everything that Woodstock stood for. And it wasn't just going to be about pop bands singing songs. It was going to have a social movement as part of it. There have been various other Woodstocks since the original, usually at a 10, 25 or a certain anniversary point.
Yeah.
Some of which have gone well and some of which have not gone well.
It's gone really badly.
At all. But there was lots of hope that this one was going to be a really good celebration of everything Woodstock was originally, with some great bands playing.
And political activism thrown into the mix, being socially conscious and discussing the issues of the day and listening to some music. One of the original organisers of the first Woodstock in 1969, Michael Lang, who's kind of spearheading this, really saying that that sort of socially conscious side of festivals in the US, at least, has been lost over the years, and he wanted to really bring it back.
Yeah, and this seemed like the moment in political history to have such a thing. So they announced that this festival was happening, and then as the months went by, various rumours started to emerge about what may or may not be going on behind the scenes, and we didn't know how much of that to believe. But then everything was kind of thrown into disarray when, a few weeks ago, it was announced that Woodstock 50 had been cancelled.
Yes.
And then about an hour later, it was announced that Woodstock 50 had not been cancelled. And so that was the point at which it was like, we don't really know what's going on here, but it is definitely officially confusing.
Yes. So what had happened was that the primary investor in the project, Amplify Live, which is a division of the marketing group Dentsu Aegis Network, had pulled its funding, and in doing that had gone ahead and just said, the whole event's off, not happening. Sorry, guys, it's all cancelled.
But they, as you say, were the financial backer. Meanwhile, the actual Woodstock company, of which Michael Lang is a key player, were like, well, nobody told us that the event was being cancelled. So they were the people who then put out a statement almost immediately saying, hey, hang on a second, the event is not cancelled, it's definitely going ahead. These guys had no right. They may be our financial backers, but they had no right to tell you that Woodstock 50 was now not going to happen.
Yes. The Woodstock company was basically saying, they're just our financiers. They've decided not to go ahead, but it's still our festival. We're still doing it. We'll find someone else to help out. The backer had gone and taken the production company that was actually managing the festival with them. So they didn't just need more money. They needed a company to put on a festival. And then certain booking agents sort of off the record said, well, our deals for our artists are with Dentsu. They're not with the Woodstock company. And so without Dentsu, our contracts are void, to which the Woodstock company was saying, no, it's all still going ahead. It's all fine. And this festival is definitely happening. So there are lots of layers of confusion to this. However, last week, because the Woodstock company went legal on this and sued Dentsu to say you had no right to announce that our festival was cancelled, we had that court hearing, we had a ruling on it, and we got some goddamn answers about what's going on.
Or at least what has happened.
Yes, maybe not what's going on.
But not necessarily what's going to happen as we move towards the planned dates for Woodstock 50 in August. But yes, as part of this court dispute, the spotlight was put on the contract between the Woodstock company and this company, Dentsu. And two questions.
So you can see why this attracted our attention.
Two questions were asked in particular, which was one, did Dentsu have the right to cancel the show on its own back without consulting Woodstock and Michael Lang and that team? And then secondly, there was a second thing that the Woodstock company wanted the court to rule on, which is that as part of this joint venture, a bank account was set up into which Dentsu put quite a lot of money. I mean, it turns out, now we've seen the contract, they were committing to spend just over $49 million on this event.
That is quite a lot of money.
And then they would recoup that out of ticket sales, and then any profits would be split between the two entities. But a joint bank account was set up, and at the time the event got cancelled, just under $18 million was still in that bank account, which perhaps understandably Dentsu took out as they were cancelling the event.
Yes, well, if you're going to pull your funding, you might as well pull your funding.
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? But the Woodstock company were trying to get the court to say they shouldn't have done that either and that the money should be returned into the festival bank account. So those were the two main things that the court...
I mean, that's key because, as far as we know, Woodstock 50 does not have new financial backing. We do know that they've tried to get it, and at least two of those companies that they've been to are Live Nation and AEG, who both declined to both fund and produce the festival.
Yes, so although the Woodstock team were adamant the event's still going to go ahead, as far as we're aware, they need to find a chunk of money to allow that to happen.
So that $80 million would really help out.
It would. So the court was asked, okay, look at the contract between these two companies. Were Dentsu allowed to cancel this event on their own? And should they be forced to return the $80 million? Straight away, without there being any proper rigorous analysis of what has happened in court down the line. And basically, the judge ruled in Woodstock's favour on the first question and in Dentsu's favour on the second, allowing both sides to basically say, ha ha, we were vindicated by this ruling. When it came to cancelling the event, under the agreement between the two sides, Dentsu and Woodstock, there was a provision that said that if Dentsu felt that Woodstock were ever in breach of the contract, they could do one of two things, which is either they could basically cancel the deal, cancel the contract and walk away, or they could take control of the event, because the Woodstock company was responsible for lots of things like booking the talent and working with the production crew and making the event happen. But if Dentsu felt that Woodstock were in breach of contract, they could basically take control of the bookings and have the relationship with the production company and be much more hands-on involved in running the event. So those were the two options open to Dentsu if they felt Woodstock was in breach of contract.
And they did take one of those options.
They did feel that Woodstock was in breach of contract, yeah. And they listed various gripes that they had with their partners, one of which was, it transpires, the original plan was for Woodstock 50 to have a capacity of 150,000.
Yep, sounds reasonable.
And then seemingly, this is certainly what it was implied in the lawsuit, at some point, the third company who were actually doing the production, who, as you've already said, also bailed on the event, at some point, as far as I can see, they said, yeah, the way we've set it up, our capacity is going to be 60,000.
Well, that's significantly less, isn't
that's it? That's a lot less tickets to sell to recoup your $49 million that you're spending. So there was
triple the cost of a ticket. Seems fine.
So there were issues over that. And then they said that they hadn't been consulted as much as they were meant to be, or at least communicated to about talent bookings. And then some deadline for having a certain number of act booked was missed, and that was meant to have an impact on the budget, and it didn't.
A type of book.
Well, they were talking about there being tiers of artists,
yeah,
and that there had to be a certain number of tier one artists booked. Tier one artists were defined as Bruce Springsteen and Drake.
The dream team.
It's quite a small tier. I mean, artists who in the last couple of years have been selling similar
not
number
Drake
of tickets.
Not Drake and Bruce Springsteen.
A double,
I mean, together as a double act.
That would be quite a headline show.
I'd go to that.
You'd go to that? Would you pay three times more?
No.
Than the original ticket price? And there were issues over certain costs, which they said they should have signed off on, and they didn't. Anyway, Dentsu reckoned that Woodstock were in breach of contract.
Yeah.
And therefore, they could either cancel the contract or take control of the event. So they decided to take control of the event.
And cancel it.
And then use that control to cancel it. And the court decided that actually they couldn't do that.
Yes.
Because there was another clause in the contract that said, if this event is going to be cancelled, both sides must agree to that cancellation in writing before it occurs. And because they had taken control of the event rather than cancelling the contract, although by doing that, the relationship between the two parties changed, the contract was still in force, and therefore so was the clause that said that cancellation could only occur if the two parties agreed. So the court said, we agree with Woodstock that under this contract, Dentsu could not on their own, even once they'd taken control of the event, which they were allowed to do, assuming we accept breach of contract, they weren't allowed to just cancel the event on their own doing. And so therefore, Dentsu were wrong in that regard. But then on the money in the bank account, they basically said the bank account was very much set up to be in the control of Dentsu. The Woodstock people were given read-only access to that account, so they could see what was happening, but they didn't have access to the money. And once they bailed on the project, Dentsu were not under any obligation. The judge basically said he certainly was ruling that he was not in a position at this stage to issue an injunction that would force Dentsu to hand over control of the bank account to Woodstock, let alone put $18 million back in there. So a mixed judgment.
Yeah, and therefore one where both sides are able to claim victory, or at least partial victory. I mean, I think they both won a bit, and they probably both got the bit that they wanted. So the Woodstock company is still able to say, this event is going ahead, it's not cancelled. And Dentsu are able to say, we're keeping that $18 million. Thanks very much.
So both sides issued statements pretty quickly once the judgment had been issued.
Yeah, so Dentsu said it felt vindicated by the judge's ruling on the bank account access. So therefore, there's its victory. They also talked about the other part of the ruling, saying that the court did not rule that our assumption of control over the festival was improper or alter that status in any way. While we understand that pursuant to the court's ruling, we cannot cancel the festival without Woodstock 50's agreement, at this time, we do not intend to further invest in the festival due to the issues noted by the court, as well as the compressed time frame and multiple health and safety concerns. Highlighting that, yeah, the Woodstock company, although they, as we'll see in a second, they've come out of this talking very positively, but they did not come out of it very well.
No, in terms of the organisation of the event, and I suppose we're not suggesting that it has been organised quite as incompetently as Fyre Festival, despite you making the comparison very much at the start of this.
As I say, not the first person to do that.
But I think it is certainly true that what Dentsu seemed to be saying, and the court ruling certainly didn't disagree with this, is August is very close and there's a lot still to be done.
Yes.
And that maybe trying to get this event to happen in August isn't wise, is certainly what Dentsu was saying. But on the other side, now we've got the issue of who has the right to cancel this event out of the way. Woodstock 50 is go.
Yes. So one organiser, Gregory Peck, said, Woodstock 50 is on! We can't wait to bring this important event to the public this summer. We have one of the greatest lineups of talent of any music festival, and we are grateful to all of the talent for their loyalty and support. Meanwhile, because you don't want just one statement, and also we've talked about Michael Lang a lot here, so we might as well have his statement too. He said, we have always relied on the truth and have never lost faith that the festival would take place. I would like to thank all of the talent and their representatives for their patience and support. Woodstock 50 will be an amazing and inspiring festival experience. So both there talked up the loyalty and support of the artists. I mean, I think the artists are just sort of in a wait and see position at the moment. Like, no one's really sure whether it's cancelled or not. No one's really sure if their contract stands or not. So they're just like, well, there's a risk that we might be in breach of contract if we pull out, because it's all very confusing. So at this stage, we'll just assume that it's going ahead and hope that it is, and hope that we're going to get paid. But, I mean, it's only mildly alarming that Michael Lang's basically saying, we just have faith that this is going to happen. If we believe it hard enough, it will happen. I mean, the original Woodstock was beset by many problems in the lead up to it and still went ahead. And also, it had many more people than the capacity of the space. So maybe they're thinking back to that. But
the world has moved on.
Well, as Dentsu points out, health and safety has really moved on since 1969. And that may as yet become a bigger issue.
So we will see. Also, as part of this, Dentsu have been told that they're not allowed to cancel the event and they're not allowed to talk about cancelling the event to anybody. So officially, the event is still definitely on, but it remains to be seen if they can find enough money to make it happen on the timescale they have. Also, they're bringing in a new production team. So who knows?
So essentially starting from scratch.
What will happen? So I think we'll be watching that with some interest. One thing that almost certainly will happen, whatever occurs in August, I suspect there's going to be more litigation. I think both sides are going to sue. I suspect that having got this injunction, Woodstock will probably sue Dentsu, saying that you damaged our reputation, you screwed up the event by making this statement, which the court has now said you shouldn't have made and you had no contractual right to make. Meanwhile, there's various breaches of contract that Dentsu were alleging. I suspect we could see some litigation on that, on their side, against Woodstock. So even if we don't get a festival, we probably will get a messy, nasty bit of litigation down the line. And, well, with Fyre Festival, that turned out to be by far the most entertaining bit. I mean, let's face it, the fallout of Fyre Festival was damn sight more interesting than anything Blink-182 are going to do on stage.
Yes.
So we will see what happens with Woodstock 50.
Yes, but as I mean, the key strap line that's always been associated with Woodstock is 3 days of peace and music, but it's rapidly becoming more like 3 months of litigation and bickering. But, and I know which I prefer.
So we will continue to watch this story with at least some interest.
But that's all we've got time for this week. Just remains for me to remind you to, I don't know, do we want people to rate and subscribe?
Rate and subscribe, why not? In your review, at the end of the last edition of Setlist, which was the Mega Upload special,
yep.
Despite earlier in the podcast you having said that you didn't want me to insert the Mega song into that podcast.
Rightly.
I snuck it in at the end.
Yes.
In order to do that, I even had to edit out of the final version earlier on where I told you I wouldn't put it in. So I edited that commitment out, snuck it in the end. I thought it was a lovely end to that podcast. Maybe it could become our theme tune and maybe people would like to support me on that mission in their review. Great podcast, would be even better if it had the Mega song as a theme tune.
No, don't write that in your review.
I'm looking,
please don't write that in your review.
Looking forward. I think the thing this
don't
podcast
encourage him.
Is lacking is a bit of a cappella jingle entertainment.
Look, I think...
As and we if all, we can't have the Mega song, then we're just going to have to get our own a cappella setlist jingle made.
Look, as we all know, I am yet to be paid for my sterling work on the music in this show.
Your and little...
And I know that there's some dispute over whether I did that as an employee and therefore it's covered in my contract.
Yeah.
Or if, as I reckon, I should be paid handsomely every time that piece of music is streamed.
For the 4 seconds you spent in GarageBand making
it. I think if you... I spent more than 4 seconds. I made multiple versions. Anyway, I think that if you start playing third-party music in and you don't pay for it, which is, sounds just like you, you having a very limited grasp on copyright law, I think that's going to cause all sorts of trouble.
I am going to have
and
a word.
And you know how finicky Kim.com gets when it comes to legal action.
I'm going to have a word with Kim.com. I'm sure he would be fine with us using the Mega song as our theme tune.
Would you have get him to re-record it? Because it would be quite confusing having a theme song that's about something else.
Well, we could rebrand the podcast to be the Mega Podcast. This is all fine. I did use Macy Gray's bit in the snippet we used last week. We'd have to get her permission as well.
I'm sure she's all right.
I think she would be up for
She'd be up for doing it. She was up for doing it. Well, all those people were up for doing the original one. Just get Kanye.
We'll get Kanye to, I always listen to Setlist. Yeah, there you go. We'll get him to do that.
Yeah.
This is really exciting.
You get it like, you know, like they do on radio. When someone comes in for a radio interview.
We don't have anyone doing interviews.
I know. But people come in for radio interviews and say, oh, could you just do some stings? And they go, oh, I love listening to 96.7 FM, the small, tiny radio station I've never heard of. And you should too.
So we could do lots of pop star interviews. Never run the interviews, but just get the idents and drop them in. We need to have a branding meeting.
Yeah, okay, well, maybe we can go and do that. But you did allude at the start of this show that you'd had to down your soup as a result of us being on a tight deadline. And now
all this waffle.
Waffling on about the mega song and using it as the theme song.
With hindsight,
for the show,
I could have leisurely eaten my soup.
We're never going to do.
And cut this bit out instead. Yeah, just do the bit you do at the end.
I haven't done that already.
You haven't done that already.
I said rate and subscribe, didn't I?
You
and
did
you
say
said
rate
review.
And subscribe.
I think there was a bit of waffle around it.
And
you did suggest
do the credits,
review.
And then we'll see. Our listeners can see what music may or may not come on in the background as you're saying it.
Well, Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty, edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to makerupload.com. No, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.